Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the Senate Committee on Health Care. I would like to open a work session on House Bill 2339A, and we're just having invited testimony up here because
there are amendments.
There are possible amendments. So would Courtney Dresser and Pat Allen please come forward? And hopefully Senator Knope will be here because he's the one that really had a lot of questions.
Text him.
Okay, so basically what I would like you to tell us...
Hello?
This is Dr. McCoy in Portland.
We are not on...
This is Oliver Jobberson, Healthcare. We're not ready for a public hearing on 2103. If you could, we'll open that public hearing in about 10 to 15 minutes. So if you could, please call back in. Thank you. So I'll just reopen the line a little bit.
Okay. Sorry. So there are concerns about... first of all, I'd like... Pat Allen, to describe the process up to now that we have had since last September.
Sure.
If you could do that.
Chairman Lewis Anderson, members of the committee, Patrick Allen, Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. This is a bill that we've been working on for some while through a work group process where we've incorporated a wide range of stakeholder perspectives, including providers, insurers, consumer groups, those kinds of things. And we've tried to get to a place where we could get a consensus bill. This is one of those topics where I think sometimes no matter how hard you try, you're not going to get to consensus. And I would say that we, although we certainly achieved some consensus on some specific questions of fact, for instance, the notion that this is a fairly small slice of what goes on out there in transactions between providers and patients. This is perhaps 3% of total transactions. We had broad agreement around some of those kinds of things, but we did not get to a place where we had broad agreement about from providers about the appropriate answer to this. I would say, as we've been working this bill through the process here in the building, we've certainly had a variety of kinds of opinions about what's here. We've had a provider group tell us they'd be fine with a percentage of Medicare as an answer. And unfortunately, their number was, I think, 1,000% of Medicare, which is a little unworkable. But, candidly, from my perspective, I think what we've gotten down to is a place where we're haggling over price. And that's really fundamentally what this ends up being at right now. But this is an issue we've tried to work very hard over the last 6 months to achieve a consensus on, and we're not at that point.
So, Courtney, remind us again why providers are not all providers, because most of this is it really comes down to just certain providers that are really involved with surprise billing. What is their greatest opposition?
For the record, Courtney Dresser with the Oregon Medical Association. I think, as the director just mentioned, a Medicare rate of 1,000. The concern is not the percentage. The concern is that we're putting Medicare into statute. Medicare is not meant to be a number or a benchmark for this type of reimbursement process. And so we're talking about two private entities, the insurer and the provider, who need to have dialogue and contract and negotiate to get these rates, to get contracts. Putting a rate of Medicare puts a target on that contract. And in our eyes, the unforeseen part, the unintended part, could be that we have more people out of network, more patients with providers that aren't in network, because the target now is lower than a commercial rate would be if they negotiated and were in network. It might be just cheaper for an insurer to just walk away from the table. So we have not so many powers to be in the sense of our ability to negotiate contracts already as providers. And so we don't want to put a target or a floor on something that we shouldn't be doing. So we have proposed some concepts, and we shared them with the director and his staff this week. And Basically, it would do first and foremost, which we all agreed, and I think this is the one of the pieces that we all did agree to in this process, is that the patients do need to be out of this process. They need to be held harmless, and if they, unless they knowingly and willingly choose an out-of-network provider, they should never see the bill. And so what would happen is that the provider and the health insurer would figure it out as they would now, but again, they would not include the patient. So that is kind of what we're proposing. And there would be no Medicare rate in there.
So you talked about $1,200. Get into the specifics of what you're asking for.
So it basically simplifies what we're trying to do. So first and foremost, the amendment would hold the patient financially harmless if there's an unexpected out-of-network care. It would simplify the process by allowing the charges for out-of-network services that are less than a certain amount. We put $1,200. The provider will be reimbursed by the insurance company for that billed amount. If the charges are above $1,200, the provider would bill the patient's insurance company based on a set of criteria to be negotiated. And it could be things like usual and customary, or the provider's charges, or some parameters. They would
stop on that. Tell me what usual and customary means when it comes to a complaint comes and you have to go through the process of.
Well, we would need to establish in a particular circumstance what usual and customary means and be able to look to some kind of a benchmark or database or something like that to determine that.
Yes, Senator Steiner Hayward.
I'm going to cut a little bit of the chase and ask Ms. Dresser one question and then potentially propose yet another alternative here that occurred to me as I was listening. I hear your point about it would be cheaper for insurers to not have people in network, but we have very strict network adequacy laws in this state, and I don't believe, I mean, I don't always agree with our commercial insurers, but I don't think they operate in that bad faith to narrow their networks that much and make so many people out of network. I don't think that's in anybody's best interest, frankly, because they want to be able to have some control over people, and if they're not in network, they can't set any parameters about testing or anything like that, and the costs just escalate. So I'm not sold on that argument at all. But it does occur to me, wonder, we have the all-payer, all-claims database in this state, right? And although contracts, this is just like me thinking as I'm listening to the two of you, so it's not fully formed, but although contracts are confidential and are subject to non-disclosure, and therefore there wouldn't be a way to do it, one could, in theory, extract data from the all-payer, all-claims database and say, what's the standard for this particular thing, that usual and customary, and set that as the benchmark and say 75% of that, or pick a number. I don't know what that number is, but or even no more than that, you know? I mean, just keep it clean, and that's an in-state thing. We've got our all-payer, all-claims database, and that gets some sense of what it does, and it gives insurers. It doesn't give insurers an incentive to negotiate any harder. It doesn't give them an incentive to kick anybody off because everybody's playing by the same rules. I don't know. But, I mean, I don't know. This is a very late idea, but I just had it sitting here listening to you guys because you were talking about how you have to figure out what usual and customary is. Well, we actually have data about that now, and you could reference all payer, all claims in statute without that being.
A couple of thoughts, Chair Monis Anderson, Senator Steiner Hayward. I think operationally, we're not quite there yet.
Okay.
With the all-payer, all-claims database, although I think we will be. But I think maybe one of the things that we may be losing sight of is that Contracts between providers and insurers are a good thing for a variety of reasons beyond price.
Mm-hmm.
They're how providers assure they've got access to the data that they need to be able to not only pay claims but be able to manage the manage the cost of care. They're how they're able to work with providers on cost reduction strategies and all kinds of things that are good with contracts. And so, a piece of what we're trying to do here is not just sort of negotiate price and not just get consumers out of the middle of a price dispute, but really, I think, incent contracting in this space. And so we're really trying to come up with an answer, we think, that spreads a little bit of – gets consumers out in a way that spreads a little bit of unpleasantness around the table 360. To put our finger on the scale a little bit more in terms of getting contracts. You'll remember we started this bill, or you wouldn't remember because it was in the House, we started this bill at 125% of Medicare, and so we've come a good distance from that. And so I think what we're really trying to do is come up with a mechanism that is clear and transparent and not subject to a lot of after-the-fact kinds of trying to figure out once the service is done how much is going to get paid for it, and try to get to a place where we have contracted arrangements, which none of this impacts anybody's ability to contract for whatever price they want to be able to contract for. And that's why we've landed where we have on this so far. I think you're right. I think your idea certainly has some merit. I don't think operationally we could make that real quite yet.
Okay. Senator Cruz.
If I could just follow up on that. Because there's regional differences too. Would all payer all claims be able to break that out as well when it's ready for prime time?
Chairman Sanderson, Senator Cruz, I believe so, but I would probably need to double check that.
Okay.
Okay. So continue with your amendment.
Yes. So just a couple things. So I think part of that process, one of the other things we did probably all agree on consensus was all payers, all claim database was not ready for this type of operation. And we did at that time suggest another third party vendor to look at these options, which does exist. I think the other issue is that there is a lot of unknowns. And so if you look at the information for emergency services, it talks about the rule of three. And the concern there is that for our emergency physician members, is that there would be lack of transparency and they would not know what they pay if they were truly getting an out-of-network cost or an in-network cost, because they don't know what the receive. So there is some lack of transparency there. So back to our concept, I think where I stopped was that there could be a payment of, if the charge is over $1,200 or a number we could agree to, that the payment to the non-participating provider would be equal or lesser to the provider's charges, the usual and customary, the charge that is mutually agreed to by the carrier and the provider within a 60-day or some type of time limit. If either party couldn't come up with a number, agree to a number, they could have a dispute go to dispute resolution or arbitration of some kind. DCPS could create the rules, but we're not asking DCPS to actually be the arbitrators because that could cause some fiscal issues for the department. I think what we're trying to say is let's keep the patient out of this and then do what providers and insurance companies do now. Talk amongst themselves and figure it out.
So when you say 3% are doing this, 3% of how many claims?
Oh, I'm sorry, Chair Monis Anderson, I don't have that number
handy. It in hundreds of thousands?
It'd be hundreds of thousands, yeah.
So in 3% of hundreds of thousands.
It's often enough that almost every legislator I've talked to has had it happen to them.
Yes. Yeah. I know I have.
Me too.
And I just ended up paying it because I didn't want to hassle the insurance company. So, and that was $900 and some. So, what I am most concerned about is the patient. And I am very concerned. I feel that this bill, no one's really happy. It seems like the consumer advocates are dissatisfied with the lack of enforcement for outlier providers. The insurers aren't happy with the reimbursement rate. The providers aren't satisfied with the reimbursement as well, but it does provide a decisive, clear, and transparent reimbursement model, and it does relieve the consumer of having to deal with this. With your amendment, what I want to get to is 3% of, say, 500,000 claims. I mean, there would be a lot of arbitration possibly going on. That would be a huge fiscal. I want to get away from the provider insurer negotiating and going to arbitration, and so that's why it's very hard for me to swallow your amendment.
Chair, if I could make one other quick comment, the $1,200 number here has caused us a little bit of head scratching as well. I just want to add to the conversation. Because we haven't seen amendment language yet, so we don't know exactly what that might look like, but as it's been presented to us, it seems like it would provide a powerful incentive for, like, $1,200 to be the floor for any number of services, because as this describes it, if the charge is less than $1,200, they'll be reimbursed for the billed amount. That feels like that means you get $1,200 regardless of what the previous price of the service would be. But that's a huge red flag for us as we look at this proposed amendment.
If I could, mm-hmm. DCBS won't do the arbitration. Who will? Because it could be a relatively large book of business.
Chairman Sanderson, Senator Cruz, we would need to create that through a rule-breaking process of what an arbitration process would look like. And I completely agree with you. This was something that we threw off the table very early on to ourselves. This is not something that providers necessarily want to do or pay for. But I hope illustrates how much we do not want a Medicare rate in statute. So we're trying to do our best to get something out there that keeps this conversation going, but holds those patients harmless.
Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Courtney, you've expressed pretty clearly that you don't want to have Medicare in set rates in state statute. I don't understand that, but I want to contrast that. Do you find Senator Steiner Hayward's suggestion of using the all-payer system, is that acceptable when it's available?
Chairman Sanderson, Senator Beyer, I think we've been told that it's not necessarily at a place where it could do that service right now.
But if it was?
I think if it got there, I think one of the things that we had expressed and we had an informational hearing here was about a third-party vendor who does this type of work in the sense that it has all of these data points and can come up with the geographical appropriate percentile of a service.
But that's Fair Health.
That's
right?
Fair Health, and I understand that DCBS concerns about Fair Health, and we've taken that off the table. But a database that could come up with those numbers, I think, is something that that was transparent, and that we could all have some confidence in those and the data that's in there. And if all payers, all claims database gets to that point, that would definitely be something we could consider.
Yeah, it does show that with the metrics that I've been given, Fair Health the providers will definitely get a lot more money through that Fair Health mix.
Madam Chair, wouldn't that depend on what percent of that database you set?
50th or 60th, or yes.
If I may, it seems like one thing, it's the people feel more comfortable going towards the system that Steiner Hayward suggested, and it sounds like they're not too far off of that. Perhaps one solution would be set a percentage of whatever database in the transition mode until that one's ready, and then go to that.
Madam Chair?
Mm-hmm.
That seems like a really interesting suggestion. My concern about putting Fair Health into statute is that now, instead of putting in a federal regulation, which we now have, we have lots of references to federal law and policy and rule in our statute. We don't, Fair Health is a commercial vendor, and we don't I'm at least as uncomfortable putting Fair Health in, more so, frankly, than putting in Medicare, because Medicare, at least at the moment, is not going away. If it does, that's a whole other problem. but I think, I mean, that's my. I'm concerned about putting Fair Health in because I think that that's. Why would we call it a private company? Yes.
If I might, I would agree with that. I guess where I was going is if people are generally agreeing that hooking on to the all-payer database that you're suggesting, I'm hearing Pat say it maybe is a year away, 2 years away.
Chairman Sanderson, Senator, I would not want to try to characterize that for this purpose without doing some significant checking, just the nature of IT.
Do you have a sense? I mean, you said that you thought it was pretty close.
I think I said it was not ready yet.
You did say that, yes.
Thank you.
Well, it strikes me that, I mean, if you're targeting to that in the short interim, it would make sense to tie it to something we all know, Medicare, because you all know what that is, and the providers are already accepting Medicare payments for Medicare patients, so that's not an unknown. And this would be... the proposals, whatever percentage, is more than you're accepting for Medicaid patients. So, and it's a small number, so it doesn't seem like that big a deal other than a philosophic point of we don't want to tie anything to Medicare.
If we put a sunset using the Medicare rate just for a temporary amount of time until we can get another better plan, I was wondering how the committee would feel about that and how you would feel about that.
That's a good solution, too. It would give us a few years. I mean, put a 3 or 4 year sunset on to give us some time to get all payer all claims up to speed.
Madam Chair, I would prefer that everybody agrees that we need to take the balance billing out of the patient's lap. And so I think that should be our number one goal. I'm willing to let the insurance companies and the providers fight out the rate until such time as the agency has the all payer all claims database available, because I don't think we're that far off. I mean this stuff is going on now, so I think the goal of this bill is to stop the patients from having to worry about these bills that just show up in the mail that they had no idea about. So, I mean, that's more where I'm at.
Yeah, Senator Beyer and then Senator Steiner Hayward.
I could go for that if we had some direction to that, and we, respecting Pat's comments, if we did away with that minimum dollar amount.
I just want to make sure I understand, Senator Knope, what you're saying. Are you saying we pass legislation that says you can't balance bill?
Correct.
Works for me.
But that would mean that the providers could charge whatever they want, correct? I would think the insurers would be opposed to that, but I don't. I mean, just that's my gut reaction.
Senators, you're right. I think it's difficult to simply prohibit balance billing without speaking in some fashion to then what if it's an out-of-network situation.
So, Senator Steiner here,
could we do it that, trying to articulate this, we're all thinking on the fly here. It's one of the rare times you actually get to see a committee thinking together. If we said that they can bill for the part that the patient would normally pay as a, if it's a percent, how do we deal with that then? Because they normally would pay a percent for, some insurance companies are set up that, some plans are set up that you pay a copay, and some are set up that you pay a percent of charges, right? Up to your deductible or maximum out of pocket or whatever, right? So if it's a copay, that's easy. You just have them pay the copay.
How about the copay or whatever the percentage would be of in-district or in-system rates?
And only have it be for emergencies and situations where it's out of the patient's control, like a pathologist or an anesthesiologist that they had no way of knowing about.
They're billable rates?
I I think what might make the most sense is for us to take what, where I think you're kind of articulating, and see if we can work on something that might meet that, and figure out where the various stakeholders are, and do a little bit of checking on whether we think we can get concurrence on it, because that's an issue too.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, this is we needed. All of us have been talking about it, and then pretty soon we get a quorum, and then we can't talk about it. So that's why we were talking about it in public this way.
Oh, please feel free.
So you do have a sense of where we're coming from.
Mm-hmm.
We don't want to go with yours, and there's a lot of.
I wouldn't go that far.
Yeah. Okay. Senator Cruz.
You know, the one thing I liked about. A fair share was the fact that it did have regional differences, and it did set a baseline, and it'd be nice to have something in that matrix. I'm not saying what it should be, Pat, but
yeah, no, I get that. Our concerns with Fair Health were simply the proprietary nature.
Right. No,
and
I understand.
Lack of transparency.
No, I fully understand that. I was just looking for a baseline that had some good numbers and also allowed for regional differences. So
yep.
Yeah.
We'll work on it.
Okay. Any other? Do you think? Okay. We are keeping this alive. It will probably be scheduled the last day. There are a whole lot of bills that are going to be the last day, but hopefully we will have some.
Wait a minute. We got it all next week.
And who knows? We may pass it out just as it is. I don't know. Okay?
Thank you.
We'll close the work session on House Bill 2339A, and we will be posting that later on. I'll open a... public hearing on 3014A. Oliver?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, before you is House Bill 3014A, brought to you by Representative Kinmer and Senator Lana Sanderson. The bill requires individuals applying for a license to practice respiratory therapy to hold a credential as a registered respiratory therapist, clarifies respiratory therapy licensing process here in Oregon, declares emergency effective on passage. No amendments, passed out of the House unanimously. We have testimony on all this.
All right. It is Dwayne and Bill Culligan.
Some sense. I looked at the data and you didn't have the data. Which one are you looking at? Maybe this one?
I'll let you go first.
Good afternoon.
Please proceed.
So this bill...
Introduce yourself first.
Oh, I'm sorry. My name is Joe Dwan. I'm the retired director of respiratory care from Kaiser Permanente in the Northwest, and I'm a national faculty for Kettering Seminars and on the OSRC board for many decades. The bill that we have presented is designed to phase out the entry-level certified respiratory therapist credential and to move to the registered respiratory therapist or the advanced therapist national credential. There are a number of states that have already done this. California's done it a couple of years ago. Washington's doing it. We're moving this direction. When we were licensed back in 1992, the technology world was significantly different than today. We deal with a lot of issues such as life support, and the equipment is phenomenally different than it was 25 years ago. And what we are looking for is to upgrade the quality of the therapist providing care for patients in the state of Oregon. And there are national board exams. There's an entry-level CRT, certified respiratory therapist level. And then there's the advanced level, which requires passing that same test at a higher level and then taking another competency exam. And that's what we're going for. We have support from all of the RT schools in the state. We have support from all the RT managers that we've spoken to. And certainly support from the Oregon Society, and we are not aware of any opposition to this. We also see it as budget neutral, as the therapist wages are not based on this credential. The other thing I wanted to look at was impact of workforce, and there are about 63 hospitals in the state, And the data I've looked at shows that we're graduating about 83 graduates a year, and we feel that that should be more than sufficient then to cover the job openings that we currently have. Any questions?
My name is Bill Cohagan. I'm manager of respiratory care services over here at Salem Hospital. I'm also a faculty member for Independence University's respiratory care program and the president of the Oregon Society for Respiratory Care. Thank you for meeting with us today. The other thing, historically, I've been a therapist myself for over 38 years. As we've grown and the technology has grown, the schools teach to this advanced credential, the RRT credential. The profession on a whole has moved this way to provide better care for patients with lung disease, which this advanced RRT credential addresses. So what we're looking at is really to move in the best way we can to provide the best care possible for our patients, both here in Oregon and nationally. I've talked with several of the managers in the state, and most of the hospitals already have it as a practice not to hire a CRT, or if they do, they have a set time limit that they have to pass this exam. The schools are regulated with the premise that the students, a certain percentage of the students, have to pass this RRT exam. So they're also very supportive of this movement. And this movement is really spreading nationally to have an RRT-only credential.
So are there going to be CRTs that will lose their jobs?
No. I'm sorry. The current workforce, those that only hold a CRT credential, will not be affected. They will still be able to hold and maintain their license, no questions asked. This is the future, the students coming out of school now.
Questions? Yes, Senator Beyer.
So, under the current educational regime, would most students, I guess there's always some who won't, but most students who have successfully completed the education, would they comply?
Yes.
All right. Seeing no further discussion, thank you. We'll be, if it's all right with the committee, schedule it for work session next week. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Close the public hearing on House Bill 3014A and open a public hearing on House Bill 2103. While we're waiting, Jen Baker, Rachel Prusak, and Dr. Pete Reagan.
Welcome to AT&T.
We'll have you go first, but we're going to get them on the line.
During the conference, as the host, press star. There are two participants on the call, including you. You are joining your conference as the host. For many of the available commands, press star pound.
This is Lori Monis Anderson. We've just opened a public hearing on House Bill 2103, and we're going to start with Jen Baker, Rachel Prusak, and Dr. Pete Reagan.
Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee, Jen Baker on behalf of the Oregon Nurses Association and Nurse Practitioners of Oregon. As many of you know, NPO was established in 1977 to promote and at times protect Oregon's progressive nurse practitioner practice. We think that's exactly what House Bill 2103 does. House Bill 2103 would allow Oregon's nurse practitioners to perform vasectomies by simply removing an arbitrary barrier that is currently in statute prohibiting nurse practitioners from performing this procedure. Oregon's nurse practitioners have earned a broad authority practicing independently in both primary and specialty care. Nurse practitioners diagnose and treat illness, prescribe and dispense medication, order and interpret tests, and provide comprehensive care to all of their patients. They do all of this with comparable outcomes to their physician colleagues. Studies show that with proper didactic training and education, NPs even match physicians on invasive procedures like chest tube placement, bedside incision, placing arterial lines. There's no reason to believe that vasectomies are any qualitatively different from any of the other procedures that nurse practitioners are performing with good outcomes on a regular basis. In fact, nurse practitioners compare well to their physician colleagues on other urology procedures like ultrasound-guided prostate biopsies. Vasectomies are more effective, safer, less invasive, and more affordable than permanent birth control options available to women. Unfortunately, here in Oregon, they're underutilized, largely because we have a shortage of providers who are able to perform the procedure. Patients are waiting up to 3 months for vasectomies in rural and urban areas alike. And despite the fact that the Oregon State Board of Nursing has stated that vasectomies fall within the scope of practice for nurse practitioners who have undergone proper didactic education, training, and demonstrated ongoing competency through a credentialing process, nurse practitioners have been specifically prohibited from performing the procedure. House Bill 2103 simply removes this outdated prohibition, creating equality within the healthcare workforce, increasing access to a safe and effective family planning procedure for Oregonians. Passage of House Bill 2103 would align Oregon's nurse practitioners with Washington State and Alaska nurse practitioners who've been performing vasectomy since 1996, when the U.S. Public Health Service Office of Population Affairs funded vasectomy training project for NPs in those two states. Expanding the number of procedures NPs are authorized to perform can improve healthcare delivery while also reducing cost, increasing access to care for Oregonians. With appropriate education, training, and credentialing, Oregon NPs can safely perform vasectomies and help to meet the current demand for the procedure.
Hello, Chair Monis Anderson, member of the committee. I am Rachel Prusak. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of HB 2103. Again, my name is Rachel Prusak. I am a family nurse practitioner. I'm also an active member of Oregon Nurses Association. I have 20 years invested in the world of nursing across a multitude of settings, including the last 10 years as a nurse practitioner. I currently work for house call providers, serving Portland's most vulnerable population, delivering home-based primary care, palliative care, and hospice care. Now participating in its fifth year of a national demonstration project, Independence at Home, House Call Providers has proven that home-based medicine improves quality and efficiency of care for the chronically ill. With the nation's best outcomes in the project, House Call Providers, which is staffed predominantly by nurse practitioners, has shown its tremendous importance in the future of national health care delivery. House Bill 2103 removes an arbitrary barrier to nurse practitioners' practice, ensuring each nurse practitioner can practice to the full extent of their education and training. Currently, nurse practitioners perform many of the same tasks that physicians do as a matter of routine with equally successful outcomes. Studies show nurse practitioners match physicians on invasive procedures like intubation, uterine aspiration for miscarriage management, vulva, endometrial, and other skin biopsies. As well as the procedures just mentioned, current statutes allow nurse practitioners to perform complex procedures, such as delivering of babies, bone marrow aspiration, lumbar punctures, all which are comparable in complexity to vasectomies. During the 5 years working in women's health, Okay, during the 5 years working in women's health, I routinely inserted intrauterine devices and performed endometrial biopsies, but only after I completed the extensive training by a clinician who was an expert in these procedures. With the appropriate education, training, competency, which are the same standards as required by our physician colleagues, credentialing and privileging, nurse practitioners are performing these procedures currently, with supports, which supports the high healthcare needs of our communities. Currently, patients throughout the state in rural and urban areas alike are waiting for vasectomy appointments because there is an increased demand as it is a low-risk procedure performed on an outpatient basis under local anesthesia. I'd like to call your attention to the informational testimony on OLIS submitted by the Oregon State Board of Nursing. When Oregon State Board of Nursing considers if a skill or procedure such as a vasectomy is within any nurse's scope of practice, it utilizes the scope of practice decision-making guidelines, a rigorous seven-step tool addressing the following. Is the role prohibited by the Nurse Practitioner Act or any other applicable laws, rules, regulations, or accreditation standards? Is performing the role consistent with professional nursing standards, evidence-based nursing, and healthcare literature? Is there practice settings, policies, and procedures in place to support performing the role, intervention, or activity? Has the nurse completed the necessary education to safely perform the role? Is there documented evidence of the nurse's current competence, knowledge, skills, abilities, and judgments to safely perform the role? Would a reasonable and prudent nurse perform the role? Is the nurse prepared to accept accountability for the role? After all seven questions are answered appropriately, then and only then can the nurse perform the role according to acceptable and prevailing standards of safe nursing care. Should this bill go forward, it would be the expectation of the Oregon State Board of Nursing that any nurse practitioner who would seek to perform the skill would first become educated, undergo training, and show competency in the procedure, become credentialed and privileged by the appropriate agency, and bill independently for these service. This rigor protects the public and holds the individual license accountable. I want everyone to understand a nurse practitioner is as conscientious as any physician when it comes to the safety of our patients. The American public has ranked nurses as the professionals with the highest honesty and ethical standards for the past consecutive 15 years. For nurses, our ethical standards translates to our clinical practice, and we would not undertake any procedure we felt was beyond the scope of our practice. While some believe this bill underestimates the importance of training, it is my hope that my testimony makes it clear nurse practitioners fully understand the value of proper education and training when it comes to the safety of our patients. I respectfully urge your support of HB 2103. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi there. My name is Dr. Pete Reagan. I'm a retired family physician from Portland. And in my practice, I did a lot of obstetrics and altogether probably performed about 1,500 vasectomies, mostly through my practice, but also for Planned Parenthood. For years, I trained medical students and residents in my office, and also including using this procedure. I've worked with many nurse practitioners, at least one of whom really wanted to learn to do vasectomy in our office and wasn't allowed to. I do not speak for a particular organization, but do speak in favor of passage of this bill. I'm impressed at the level of discussion that's already been held in the House chamber, especially with the presentation by Dr. Fuchs, who's here today. I really want to acknowledge and appreciate his extremely detailed, in-depth familiarity, knowledge with both the procedure and the process of learning it. And I really agree with him that the nuance and subtlety of the procedure tends to be underestimated in training, both for doctors and for anyone else who might be trained to do it. It is a serious procedure. Much of the procedure is performed by feel, which is a learned skill and requires detailed anatomical knowledge and sensitive fingers. Performing a vasectomy is a significant commitment with unpredictable surgical demands and important possible complications, and it's unquestionably critical that a trainee experience a significant number of procedures before practicing without any supervision available. However, I still support this bill to allow vasectomy to be included as a possible procedure for an advanced care nurse. As you've heard, advanced care nurses are taking responsibility for delivering babies, which also have many unpredictable consequences that might require sudden high skill. Vasectomies have been performed by nurse practitioners in Alaska and Washington for a decade without apparent decrease in safety. Studies specifically of nurse practitioner data have not yet been published from those two states, but other data on complications for vasectomy, depending on experience and training level, suggest that early trainees performing procedures under supervision do not experience higher rates of complications than do senior residents or staff physicians. Further, please note that the common complications of vasectomy, which while sometimes serious and even occasionally debilitating, are very rarely life-threatening, and it is common for nurse practitioners to accept responsibility for treatments causing this level of complication. I've personally trained people at all levels of medical training, including experienced private physicians, as well as first-year medical students with no prior surgical experience, and I did not find general surgical experience necessarily generalized to being able to learn vasectomy. My all-time most adept trainee was one of the first-year students who had just a general kinesthetic skill at the gifted level. Designing the specific requirements for training should be a very serious undertaking by the Oregon Board of Nursing, but this remains a reasonable level of responsibility for them, and this wheel has already been invented in two other states. I personally am not prepared to argue whether Oregon already has enough vasectomy practitioners without this bill, but I do feel that a conscientious nurse practitioner could be taught to do the procedure as well as I could as a family physician. I think that's – I also included in my notes the story of Vivian Thomas, who was a high school graduate, grandson of slaves, who became a noted pediatric cardiac surgeon. Just to point out that surgical acumen is not about the degree after your name. It's about the experience, the practice, and also some innate skill.
Thank you. Question for this panel. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And let's go to the people on the phone. Is Greg McCoy on the phone? Get off mute. Is Brian O'Hallard on the phone?
Yeah, this is Greg McCoy.
Okay, let's start with Greg McCoy, please.
Thank you. You still there?
Yes.
Okay. Madam Chair, Vice Chair Cruz, and esteemed members of the Senate Health Committee, thank you for letting me testify by telephone. I'll read a letter that I sent to my state representative a few weeks ago, and then I had some parting comments.
Okay, please state your name for the record.
This is Gregory McCoy. I'm a board-certified urologist in Portland, Oregon. I'm writing as a practicing urologist in the greater Portland area for 30 years and a concerned citizen. I typically see multiple complications per year due to vasectomies performed by family practice doctors, too. These are MDs, some of which have not had adequate surgical training to be doing this procedure. The typical complication is scrotal hematoma, which requires surgical exploration and evacuation of a grapefruit-sized clot, or allowing the patient to languish for 4 to 6 weeks while the hematoma resolves. The former option is expensive, and the latter option may be expensive in terms of patient missing work. Other less frequent complications include infection and failure of the vasectomy, resulting in unwanted pregnancy. About 6 months ago, I got an urgent call from a family practice physician who realized that during the vasectomy, she had cut the testicular artery. The patient arrived at my office about a half hour later, freely bleeding from this injury. It was difficult, but we were able to stop the bleeding, and he did not lose his testicle. The surgeon should be able to take care of his or her complications. A nurse practitioner has far less training than a family practice physician. A family practice physician does have surgical training during rotations in medical school and has more surgical training during a residency program. Repetition leads to excellent results in surgery as well as other endeavors. Perhaps you have read Outliers by Malcolm Gladwell. Spending hundreds of hours repetitively perfecting a person's expertise leads to superlative outcomes as experienced by Bill Gates and others in this book. Surgical residency training under supervision would be the optimal way to achieve this. A nurse practitioner with little or no surgical training cannot be expected to produce superior results, and there will be significant complications. I am at a loss to understand why there would be a movement to have nurse practitioners with no formal surgery training begin to do vasectomies. I am unaware of any shortage of urologists or family practice physicians to perform this challenging procedure. On the contrary, the urologists I know, including myself, would be able to do several additional vasectomies per week. Whether this proposal is for the benefit of the nurse practitioners as a group or Planned Parenthood is not apparent. I cannot conceive of a scenario where this is in the best interest of the average patient. The only way I could conceivably support passage of this bill would be if the Oregon legislators were consigned to having their vasectomies done by suboptimally trained providers such as nurse practitioners. If this were the case, it would be a very short-lived law, I can assure you.
I really take offense at that, frankly. I really take offense at that.
Clinic, I thank you for my ability to give my opinion.
I don't want
and urge you to oppose this legislation.
TMI, Cruz.
Thank you very much. Let's go through all those that are on the phone, and then we'll have comments from the panel. I mean, from the legislators. Okay, is it Brian O'Hallard?
Yes. I'm Brian O'Haller, and I'm a board-certified urologist. I've been in practice for approximately 30 years. I've done over 5,000 vasectomies, and I've got a few thoughts. When a bleed or abscess occurs after any surgery, be it surgical removal of a kidney, a bladder, or a prostate, we're trained to reoperate, find the problem, and fix it.
Never.
We do it with little fear because we've been trained over 6 years and many years in practice to know the anatomy and be able to fix the problem. It's usually easily identified. As a urologist, one of the most terrifying things I experience is just what Greg described, being faced with an unfortunate patient with a huge scrotal bleed, the scrotum's the size of a football, tense with blood, and having to re-explore it, stop the bleeding, or drain the abscess, and avoid damaging the very fragile blood supply in a markedly enlarged spermatic cord. If the blood supply to the testicles is damaged, the testicles die. Another problem we see is a poorly trained person starting a vasectomy, then having to stop halfway because they can't identify the vas. So the patient goes through a surgical procedure and all the anxiety, and the procedure has to be stopped. Decisions like this were frequent in the 80s and 90s. We frankly had no concern or regard for patient safety. Today, things have changed. There's a culture shift, and no healthcare decision is made without first asking the question, how does this affect patient safety? We're scrutinizing ourselves now, eliminating patient harm, and changing the culture in the hospital so any problem, be it from the pharmacy, from the operating room or on the medical floor or the emergency room, is written down. All complications are now tracked by the hospital and by Medicare, and even the smallest complications are scrutinized by a team of healthcare professionals and plans put in place to eliminate those mistakes. As an example, years ago, anybody used to be able to put in a Foley catheter. Now, because of the small risk of a urinary tract infection with a Foley catheter insertion, it's standard to have two nurses place each Foley catheter in Bend, Oregon, and all of the St. Charles hospitals throughout Eastern Oregon. As a result, UTIs from Foley placement have essentially been eliminated, and that's tracked by Medicare, as are all other potential patient harm events. There's no tolerance for any practice today that compromises patient safety. Allowing someone with the same formal surgical training during their training period as a gas station attendant to perform surgery on someone's testicles is not putting patient safety first. They don't track their complications in Washington. It's not published in our journals, and there is absolutely no way that somebody with no formal surgical training during their training period should be allowed to do this to people. These people do not and will never have privileges at our hospital to perform vasectomies, and I sit on the board. They're not adequately trained. They cannot take care of the potentially horrific complications. We have to take care of those complications. Why should they be allowed to do so in the community, leading the public to believe that they are formally surgically trained and that they understand the complex anatomy that they so frequently call simple? It's not simple, and it's not a simple procedure. If they've done 100 and it's been simple, they're about ready to run into trouble. They cannot step in when a problem occurs. There is no access issue in Central Oregon. If they say that there is an access issue, I'd love to talk to them. I absolutely oppose this, and I think it's a huge step backwards as we're trying to decrease patient harm by a culture change in healthcare today.
Thank you. Is Dr. Barrett on the phone? Anyone else on the phone that has not had a chance to speak? Any comments?
Oh, yeah, I have a few.
Senator Steiner Hayward?
You know, when I was in medical school, about 30 years ago now, I was back east, and I knew I wanted to be in family medicine, and I knew I wanted to do operative obstetrics, C-sections, deliver twins, that kind of thing. And I was on my OB rotation, and the head of the OB department said to me, well, we're thinking about setting up an OB fellowship for family medicine here, so you could do a fourth-year training and get a little more experience if you wanted to do obstetrics. And I said, and he said, would that kind of thing you'd be interested in? I said, well, first of all, I think we get plenty of training in our residency program to be able to do obstetrics, all the basic stuff. And second of all, I'd only be interested if I was sure I was going to get enough C-sections as primary surgeon to be able to get privileges. And he was a very tall man. He stood up very tall, looked at me over his half glasses, and said, no family physician will ever perform C-sections in my hospital. And I said, well, then I'm not interested in your fellowship. Now, Dr. O'Halloran, I appreciate your concerns, and I'm obviously very concerned about patient safety, too. But I did over 50 C-sections as primary surgeon in residency, and I did them out in private practice, and I did them at OHSU, and I never had a significant complication. Family physicians do all sorts of things really well. Have you seen complications from vasectomies done by family physicians? Sure you have. Because you see the complications, and you don't see the hundreds that go well. I can't even begin to tell you how personally insulted I am and how insulted I am on behalf of my very skilled colleagues across the state by things that both of you have said. I apologize if I sound intemperate, but I'm pretty dismayed by those comments, and I'm even further dismayed by the dismissive level of comments that you've made against our nurse practitioner colleagues. They know their scope of practice. They are experienced. They won't do this if they don't feel competent to do it.
Okay.
Let me respond to that.
Yes.
I do not mean to disparage family practice docs. Family practice docs have formal surgical training. This is directed towards nurse practitioners who do not have formal surgical training and should not be pretending that they understand the complex anatomy of the scrotum or the spermatic cord. I bet if I asked any nurse practitioner right now sitting there to explain to me what the anatomy is of the spermatic cord and what structures are in it, that they couldn't do it.
Well,
does anybody want to take that on?
We will be having Susan King coming up and we'll, later on, but there will be a training component in there. I don't believe any nurse practitioner would become certified in this without proper training. Any other
but
comments?
Proper training doesn't occur after watching somebody do 5 to 10 procedures. Proper training occurs over the course of 5 to 6 years in operating on multiple spermatic cords for a multitude of problems. You can't learn the anatomy and the potential problems that can occur by doing a few vasectomies. That's my point.
Thank you. Any other comments? All right, let's have Eugene Fuchs and Susan King in this discussion.
Go first. Madam Senator Mona Sanderson and other distinguished members of the panel. My name is Eugene Fuchs. I'm from Portland, Oregon. I'm a professor of urology at Oregon Health Sciences University, where I've been for 42 years, and during that time have trained nearly 100 urologists to do vasectomies and some family doctors to do vasectomies. I also my practice was almost exclusively for the last 10 or 15 years in reproductive medicine, so I've had the opportunity to see lots of vasectomy complications that are referred in, as well as, unfortunately, having to review dozens and dozens of medical charts for men who have brought legal action against the operator who did their vasectomy. You've heard about from Dr. McCoy and Dr. O'Halloran, so I won't push that point. What I'd like to talk about today is this concept of scope of practice. I, as a board-certified urologist, fully licensed in the state of Oregon, cannot tomorrow say, I'm going to start doing breast biopsies, despite the fact that I probably have the surgical ability to do it. It simply doesn't fall into my scope of practice. It isn't what I was trained to do. By the same token, a gynecologist who is fully trained would not dream of doing a vasectomy. Family docs do it, and very appropriately, but a gynecologist doesn't offer vasectomies to the spouses of his patients. In Oregon, in Portland especially, the centers that do women's health do not do vasectomies for the spouses or the partners of their clients because it doesn't fall into their scope of practice, despite the fact that they have fully trained surgeons on the staff. So it kind of mystifies me how the nurse practitioners can suddenly say this falls into the scope of their practice when, by educationally, they lack the didactic or clinical experience surgically. So that has been a concern of mine for some time. I searched the literature to find out about the scope of practice thing that we all talk about, particularly as it refers to nurse practitioners. In 2009, a paper was published discussing the procedures that are done by appropriately done by nurse practitioners who work in a urologic practice, and they provide a huge list of things that are appropriate: biopsies, cystoscopy, all sorts of things like that. They never mention vasectomies. A couple of years later, actually in 2015, another paper came out, published by Eastern Michigan University Nursing School of Faculty, discussing the same topic. What are the competencies that a nurse practitioner working in an adult urologic practice can achieve? And again, vasectomy does not appear on their list. Unfortunately, as I think has been referenced even by Dr. Reagan, that this procedure is underappreciated. Everybody thinks it's a simple thing. You walk into the office, get it done, you walk out, no complications. And as you heard from Dr. McCoy and Dr. O'Halloran, that is too frequently not the case. The incidence is low, but you know, is 2 out of 100 acceptable, 5 out of 100 acceptable with big scrotal hematomas? I don't know the answer to that. But I do know that I've dealt with these over the years. There's one avenue that I think is open to family nurse practitioners and nurse practitioners who work in a urologic practice, and that is to become certified as a urologic nurse practitioner. This certification is available. It requires 800 hours working in a urologic practice and passing an exam. Those individuals, given the right circumstances, given the right mentorship, can certainly learn how to do vasectomies. No question about it. I have to reference the Washington and Alaska practice of nurse practitioners doing vasectomy. When this issue came up 2 years ago, I got a call from a urologist in Olympia, Washington, who said that she has been seeing complications from the nurse practitioner, I believe at Planned Parenthood, is doing vasectomies. And she called me again a couple of days ago and said that she affirmed that has been happening. I don't know the numbers. I have never seen a publication about the safety of these nurses doing these procedures. So, but that's at least an anecdotal thing to it. And then finally, in this very important paper that was published about competencies for nurse practitioners in adult urology patients, they specifically state that, oh, and I might add that this is considered important enough to earn CNE credit for nurses, which is generally considered to be a state-of-the-art paper. And what they specifically state in this paper is that, let me read it. These competencies, referring to the ones they had referred to, are not permitted to expand one's NP practice beyond the bounds of the original generalist certification. That is, they are not a mechanism for a women's health nurse practice to care for adult male patients. And this is exactly the situation what I referred to with the women's health centers in Portland especially. They don't do vasectomies. They're gynecologists, and nurse practitioners don't do vasectomies. It particularly applies to Planned Parenthood. I know has been pushing this bill because I'm their pro bono vasectomy director, so I'm aware of that. But that is a women's health clinic. And yet they are proposing that their nurse practitioners who don't deal with men at all, maybe occasional STD, but they want to do vasectomies. And I think it's not appropriate. So I urge you to consider this bill and hopefully reject it.
Thank you.
I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions for Dr. Thank you. Susan King.
Good afternoon, Senator Monis Anderson and members of the committee. My name is Susan King. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Nurses Association. Although I was educated as a nurse practitioner, I don't practice as one. I'd like to just refer to a few of the points that have been made in the last testimony. The first is regarding scope of practice. And I've been at this a few years and have been through many of the discussions about scope of practice for a variety of providers, including nurses and nurse practitioners. When I exited nursing school in 1971, my practice looked very different than it looks today. I've been practicing for 46 years. Currently, I'm an emergency nurse. I worked last night. And the things that I do now are far more complex than those that I did in 1971. RNs, let alone nurse practitioners, are responsible for very invasive procedures such as placing central lines and other procedures that are equally complication potentials as are vasectomies. No one who is a nurse practitioner in the state of Oregon that I know would minimize that any surgical procedure, and many of the medical procedures that all of us do, whether we're registered nurses or nurse practitioners, requires extensive training, not only didactic but clinical training, and competency demonstration. So it isn't a matter of watching a film and doing four or five procedures, as has been referred to in prior testimony. It is, in fact, having didactic, having supervised practice, and then a detailed competency checklist to prove that one is competent to do a certain procedure. I also know of no nurse practitioner who is going to feel competent doing very few procedures. What we are asking for in this bill is to remove an outdated, unusual prohibition, a specific procedure-specific prohibition in statutes that are referenced to sterilization. The statute has nothing to do with the scope of practice as defined in ORS 678. So what I would like to underscore is that you have not heard from nurse practitioners that the vasectomy is being dismissed as complication-free or something that should not be taken very seriously. In 1979, nurse practitioners couldn't perform medications, and some of the same arguments that I'm hearing opposed to this bill were used to claim that nurse practitioners could not safely prescribe. We now have over 30 years of experience showing that the data is clearly against that point of view. There have been many other issues that we have brought before this body over the last 30-plus years for nurse practitioners, and I would say to you that my organization has never asked for authority for something that our members intend to treat lightly. We have kept our faith with the legislature that gave prescriptive authority in 1979 that we would ensure appropriate training and that we would do our very best to be safe practitioners, and I think you have seen a long track record in Oregon. A couple of other things I would just like to add and then be happy to answer any questions. Currently, the same statute that you are looking at under this bill allows physician assistants to perform vasectomies. In fact, it's much broader than just performing vasectomies, and I have heard no testimony by our physician colleagues raising that issue. And nurse practitioners are far more established in terms of provider groups within the state of Oregon and across the country and have a long track record on a variety of procedures and interventions. So I would like to point out that there is an inconsistency even within this statute. I'm very happy to answer any questions that you might have. And, of course, I urge you to support this bill. It's an access issue, perhaps not in all places, but in many and some, and those providers who would be intending to learn this procedure and perform it would do so under the safety culture that has been described in previous testimony. Thank you.
Just one question, Susan. There have been statements on surgical training, and so since this is going to be a part of the training, can you just let the committee know a little bit about surgical training? I know you're doing inline, so I assume that that's a part of the protocol training that would happen.
Senator Monis Anderson, not having been trained in surgical procedures, I'm going to go out on a little bit of a limb, but I will talk to you about the procedure that I mentioned that an RN can do. And that training, placing central lines, for example, involves didactic training that has extensive anatomy involved. It deals with complications, risks, procedures, patient education, informed consent. And then there is a clinical component, which actually is watching procedures and then demonstrating those procedures under close supervision. Following any kind of procedural training that I am aware of, there generally is an extensive checklist, starting with such things as adequate hand washing, adequate sterile technique, adequate manipulation of any equipment that is used, and adequate completion of a procedure, just to name a few of the things that would be on the checklist. I cannot imagine, others can probably speak more specifically as experts, but I cannot imagine that a procedure such as a vasectomy would carry with it any less detailed training requirements than that.
Thank you. Any other questions for this panel?
Could I make a comment?
One more?
Is that okay?
Yes.
Yeah. I would just like to say I don't want to come out sound like I'm disparaging nurse practitioners. We have four nurse practitioners working in our practice at OHSU, and they do a wonderful job. And they have no inclination to do vasectomy, but they're highly specialized nurse practitioners. Secondly, what people have mentioned, chest tubes, artelines, so on and so forth, those are usually placed, for instance, in trauma centers, in hospital, where there's a lot of backup. There's a backup if there's a problem. But that doesn't happen in an isolated vasectomy clinic, where if you run into a problem, you don't have a backup. And that's my biggest problem with this proposal, is what you do when a nurse practitioner working solo has no backup and she runs into a scrotum that's bleeding. She's not going to be able to open that scrotum and search for a bleeder. And my other objection is that nurse practitioners who work in women's health with no contact with men whatsoever are proposing to do vasectomies. We don't, the gynecologists would never dream of doing that, and or obstetricians, family docs who do everything like that, that's perfectly acceptable. They do a fine job.
Thank
but
you.
That's my major objection.
Thank you. Senator Beyer?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Doctor, wouldn't that situation be the same? Wouldn't that be true also in a single practitioner family practice office?
Yeah, but I'm not. Family docs know how to do that. They've had surgical training, and Dr. Steiner Hayward mentioned that she had extensive training by any standard.
One final word, Susan?
No, thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. And colleagues, will you let me know how you feel about this bill? And you'll know Friday if it's posted for work session or not. With that, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2103 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2527A.
Right, Madam Chair, members of the committee, before you, this House Bill 2527A, brought to you by Representative Bueller and Senator Steiner Hayward. The bill allows organ pharmacists to prescribe and administer injectable contraceptives approved by the Federal Food and Drug Administration. No amendments.
Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you. I'll kick it off. Chairman Anderson, thank you very much for having us. For the record, my name is Representative Newt Bueller. I represent House District 54, which is most of the city of Bend. I bring to you House Bill 2527, passed with overwhelming bipartisan support, and it's really a continuation of work that many of you on this committee helped us with last time, making Oregon the first state in the nation to make oral hormonal birth control essentially and functionally over-the-counter, and has been very successful. I'm happy to report nearly 3,000 pharmacists have gone through the certification program, and thousands of prescriptions have been picked up by women all over Oregon by just walking into their local pharmacy, filling out a questionnaire. 90% of them successfully fill out the questionnaire, and there's no contraindication, and 10% need further evaluation, or that's just not a good option for them. What this bill does is just extend it to more methods of birth control. Self-administered birth control is how it's defined in the bill, which means patches, vaginal rings, and some type of injectables. So I'd love to have your support and continue the good work we did back in 2015. And with that, I'll hand it over to my co-sponsor.
I get two microphones? I don't think that's a good idea. Good afternoon. For the record, Elizabeth Steiner Hayward, State Senate District 17, Northwest Portland and Beaverton, and I'm honored to be here with my colleague, Representative Bueller, with whom I worked in 2015, along with many of you, to pass the original legislation. I can't tell you how happy it's made a lot of women in this state to be able to walk into their local pharmacy and see the sign that says, get your birth control prescription here. I can't tell you as a family physician how many times I got calls at 10 o'clock at night saying, I'm running out of birth control, or at, 4 o'clock on a Sunday when I can't really do much about it, but now they can walk to their pharmacy and get that prescription. And it's a sign of how much our pharmacists want to be active partners with us in providing comprehensive, easily accessible care to women, that 3,000 of them across the state have already received this training and are offering this service to women. The ones that we're proposing to add are equally simple, they're equally effective, and they're equally safe. And it's simply a matter of kind, not a matter of degree. And so this is a really simple expansion, and I, too, would urge your support.
Thank you. Questions for, yes, Senator Cruz?
We could have had at least one reunion of the work group from 2 years ago before we did this.
No, we didn't meet that.
Well,
no, sir.
May I comment on that? it was the intention of the work group, which Senator Cruz was on all along, to kind of expand it slowly over time. The reason we did it initially exclude these methods is just we didn't want to overwhelm the system and the pharmacist and the training program.
So. Right. Great. Exactly. And the reason we include self-administered injectable Depo-Provera or other hormonal ones is because pharmacists already do lots of injections, and they have that within their scope of practice. It's perfectly reasonable for them to do.
Senator is just giving you a bad time, you know that.
It's all good.
Okay.
It's all good.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yeah. I'll call up Bill Cross and Paige Clark. Oh, Nikki will come instead of Bill.
Good afternoon, Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee. Nikki Terziev, not Bill Cross, here to deliver some less entertaining
taking testimony on behalf of the Oregon State Pharmacy Coalition. We are in full support, obviously, of this expansion. It's a natural expansion of the legislation that we had been working on and collaborating with Representative Bueller, Senator Steiner Hayward. Thank you to them for their leadership. I've got Paige Clark next to me, who is really a key player from the pharmacy vantage point in developing this program and helping to implement it. So I will pass it to her for any detailed questions.
Good afternoon, Chair Mona Sanderson and committee. I'm Paige Clark. I've been a pharmacist here in Oregon for 32 years, have worked for the Oregon Board of Pharmacy, and currently actually work for Oregon State University College of Pharmacy, in which I do a lot of educational endeavors and a lot of professional development sorts of things. I am here today as a pharmacist in front of you, and I certainly could answer questions if the committee has any on the implementation. Oregon certainly has led the way in this capacity, and I think many, many people are grateful here in the state and also across the nation for the leadership shown for women's care in this capacity. So I really don't have anything other than that to say to you, but I could certainly answer a question if you had some.
I have a comment. One of my friends is a pharmacist, and when I first told her about prescribing at her pharmacy, oh, no, we can't do that. No, she's a 100% supporter. Yeah. So, yeah, it's amazing how culture changes. Yeah. All right, Senator Cruz.
Yeah, Madam Chair, just to reassert the fact that this was the plan 2 years ago. We were just doing it in phases. So this is absolutely appropriate, and it's the right thing to do.
I apologize.
It's okay. Thank you very much. Okay. All right. And I know that there's no opposition to this, so we will schedule that for sure. All right. With that, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2527A and open a public hearing on House Bill 2839A.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, before you is House Bill 2839A. The bill prohibits covered entities, including health care service organizations, licensed health professionals, and health insurers, from determining an individual ineligible to receive an organ transplant due to a disability if the individual meets eligibility requirements for a transplant. There is a -A2 amendment, which I believe Paul will speak to, and minimal fiscal impact, no revenue impact, as it made its way over from the House, and it passed out of the House unanimously.
Thank you, Chair Mona Sanderson and members of the committee. My name is Paul Turtle, and I'm a resident in Northwest Portland. And this is a bill that I really like, that I think can really make a big difference. And what it does is it basically sort of clarifies and spells out that individuals with disabilities shouldn't be denied access to an organ transplant simply because they are disabled. Simply because they have a disability.
Oh, yes.
Obviously, if there's something about the disability that would make the transplant simply not work, that's different. And the bill specifically permits transplant centers to make a reasonably objective determination about that. There was a version of this bill that was passed 20 years ago in California based on a woman with, I believe, Down syndrome who was denied a transplant and successfully worked through that. After her experience, California passed a bill in the 1990s that would prohibit that. Nationally, in the last few years, there has been a renewed interest in this issue. In several states, I believe Maryland, Massachusetts, and New Jersey have recently passed similar legislation, and as I believe you noted, the members of Congress have asked DHS to weigh in on that also. This national work was actually in response to a child from Oregon. There was a boy, Leif O'Neill, who several years ago, when he was at the age of about 9 or 10, had a viral infection that damaged his heart, and he needed a heart transplant. Because of his very severe autism, the family was originally told that they simply couldn't be considered for an organ transplant. They were essentially told, I'm sorry, but you need to prepare for your child's imminent death. And you know, one of the physicians at OHSU really went to bat for them and basically got Stanford Medical Center to reconsider. And he is alive and thriving today. And although he still has very severe autism and still cannot speak, he came to our house health hearing with his mother and basically testified through a keyboard to sort of, you know, explain, you know, how grateful he was for a chance to continue living. And there, what this bill does really is it basically just spells out that if, you know, even if someone is disabled, you have to consider reasonable accommodations before making a decision about, you know, denying a transplant. And, you know, the version you see, the engrossed bill, is a huge improvement over the version that I originally submitted. It was written by OHSU in Providence in consultation with the transplant centers. They based their work on legislation enacted in Massachusetts last December, which in turn was based on work by advocacy organizations, and I'm really grateful to them for their work on this. It's a much better bill. The A2 amendment is something that we tried to get into the bill the first time around with in the House. There was some language that OHSU had developed in consultation with us that a legislative council couldn't understand, and so they just left it out. And so what we have done is we've basically, you know, gotten together and put it back in. Basically what it just says, the part of what the bill does is it establishes an expedited judicial review process so that if a patient feels that they have been discriminated against on the basis of their disability, they can quickly take their case to a judge to get that heard and resolved on a very rapid basis. And because of the tort notice, you know, tort claims notice procedures, we wanted to make sure that there was a reasonable way for an OHSU patient to get their expedited review without exposing OHSU to, you know, extra damage clauses, and that's what the A2 amendment does.
Will that propose a possible fiscal?
We don't think so.
Okay, I just wanted you to know we'll be sending it to fiscal, hopefully.
Yeah, so we don't think there would be a fiscal, but again, I would hope, you know, they would weigh in on that.
Okay. They will. Yeah.
Okay. So I guess it does specifically make it clear that there are, you know, it does not create a right of damages against a public body that doesn't already exist. So any question? I guess the one thing I would say is there's a written testimony in the record from Jessica Bodie in the House Healthcare Committee hearing, and you know, I would encourage you to go back and read her letter because I think she really told her story very well.
We did send a copy of your amendment to everybody, and you had quite a list, so a lot of people had been weighing in on this bill. The only response we haven't gotten back is from Representative Williamson's herself, and they are looking on it. So I don't think the committee is going to have any problems with this.
Okay.
Thank you. With that,
I will close
the public hearing on House Bill 2839A, and colleagues, we are adjourned.
Except for you and me.
Except we are adjourned.
Except for you and me.